The Running Won't Save You podcast season 3 is proudly sponsored by our friends, the Pick and Mix Ninjas at X Miles. How exactly is it possible to get 150 grams of carbs into your body without having a trail accident, I hear you ask? Well, I can't help you there, but what I can help you with is calculating what has 150 grams of carbs in it using the X Miles nutrition calculator, which is free on their website. You just go on there and add all the things that you feel like eating into the basket, and it'll tell you exactly how many carbs, how many proteins, how many sugars, how many calories, how many this, how many that in the nutrition calculator. It is honestly super, super handy and stops you having to read those tiny, tiny little bits of writing on the back of things. So, this season, our wonderful friends at X Miles, I keep referring to them as our wonderful friends, I don't even know if they like me, are giving us a 12-month subscription to X Plus, which is their membership platform, where customers can receive better pricing on single serves, free priority shipping, express order fulfillment, and 5% store credit whenever they go shopping, plus access to exclusive sales. They're giving us a 12-month subscription plus a nutrition bundle, which is a mystery bundle, like a tin of mystery meat in Lidl. This is a mystery bundle of nutrition. If you want to enter the competition, you can go to our Instagram page, which is Running Won't Save You Pod on Instagram. Click and enter the competition. This competition is running till the end of June. Or if you just want to go on there and order some Vela Forte, Tailwinds, Squirrel's Nut Butter, Active Root, High Five, Low Five, Medium Five, whatever five it is that you want to order, whatever food it is you want to order, whatever nutrition it is you're looking for, then head to the website, put it all into the nutrition calculator, put it all in your basket, and enter the code RWSY1010 at the checkout for 10% off. Thanks, guys. We love you. You're amazing. Honestly, I've probably used X Miles more than any other website in the last sort of 10 weeks prepping for the spine. It's great. It's quick. It's easy. And it is cheap. On with the podcast. Welcome to the Running Won't Save You podcast, season 3, episode 10, which means it's time to do a grown-up interview with an actual proper person who knows what they're talking about. Today I'm joined by Joseph Perry, who is an actual proper psychologist, sports psychologist, specialising in runners, business people. She runs Performance in Mind. She's written books. Damien thinks she's amazing. That's why we got her on. So does Kirsty, actually. There's some big fans here, Josie. Welcome to the podcast, Josie Perry.
Yeah, I'm slightly concerned about being called a proper grown-up. That's a lot of pressure.
It's a little bit, but sometimes I'm like, none of us are qualified to talk about this stuff. It's literally just our opinions.
So you actually do it.
That is true. But still, I'm like, am I allowed to say this? Or is somebody going to come down? This morning I had a new athlete who's a psychiatrist who runs two practices and wants me to coach them. And I'm like, fuck. Like, you know, you get that imposter syndrome thing. So that's fun. Anyway, tell us a bit about what you do for people that don't know. Give yourself a little tiny sales pitch.
So yeah, I'm a sports psychologist. Officially, we're sport and exercise psychologists, but very few people want exercise psychology support. I specialise with people who have performance anxiety. Ooh. And people who have ADHD. And often that's very similar. If you have ADHD, you're very likely to also have performance anxiety when it comes to your sport. So I work a lot in endurance sports, mainly because that's where my heart is. Mm-hmm. I got into sports psychology through triathlon.
I'm so sorry. Have you been cured?
Are you still suffering? I've got an injury. And so actually my running plans are a little bit on hold at the moment because I think I've got a stress fracture in my foot.
Oh, wow. Not just a little one, then a big one.
Yeah, really annoying. So actually, I'm doing more swimming and cycling and a lot of reformer and a lot of... I've just got into calisthenics, which is actually...
What is calisthenics?
Fun. It's basically TRX with hoops.
Okay, sounds fun. Sounds like Cirque du Soleil.
Yeah, kind of. And I do this is my favourite. I do 90 minutes of gymnastics club on a Sunday where literally...
Have you got a ribbon on a stick?
No, we're doing proper stuff. We're doing like somersaults and tumbles and vaults and stuff that looks terrifying.
It's amazing.
It's so much fun.
So jealous. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, none of that's the grown-up sports like stuff. But so I do love sport, and I love understanding how the brain works in sport, and I love taking people on that journey from having some kind of barrier where they are not able to get the most out of themselves because it feels like their brain is in the way, and getting them to that goal that they've been working towards.
I feel like that's 90% of people.
Probably.
Yeah.
Which is helpful when it's your business.
Absolutely. So tell me about the sort of people you work with. Is it like high-end, top level Olympic athletes, or are you kind of working with all sorts of people?
Anyone. So yes, I've worked with some Olympic gold medalists, but I've also worked with people who want to do their first park run and are too afraid to show up because people might laugh at them, or they might be judged, or they're not good enough, or they don't want to come last. So the full range of, like, I am trying to set a new world record for running this fastest known time route, through to I want to start. Lots and lots of kind of age groupers who have set themselves a really cool goal, but then just want to make sure that they have done everything possible to reach that goal. So I call it like my no stone unturned package of, like, we will figure out all the things that might get in the way of you performing at your best, and we will give you those strategies to deal with them.
What do you think, or what's the thing that you come up against, well, you see the most when you are talking to athletes? What's the thing that makes them, what is the thing that holds them back the most? What part of their, I don't say brain makeup, but I get a lot of I'm not good enough. I don't think I'm good enough. What is it that you get presented by people that come see you?
Yeah, around that. So particularly because people tend to come with the performance anxiety, it is their threat system that's getting in the way. So the way I describe it is that we have three key functions in our brain that we need to know about if we want to do something difficult. We've got a habit function, and we want as much of what we do to be habitual. We don't want to have to think about how do we run, or how might we use poles to go up a big hill. We want that automatic because we've done it thousands of times before. That makes life so much easier. No choice points. You just get on and do it. We then have our logic function, which is awesome. When there's a decision to be made, that bit kicks in. That's our prefrontal cortex right at the front of our brain. That will kick in. That will drill back to your hippocampus, which is all your memory and your knowledge, and you'll be able to pull out really good answers. And the longer you've been doing your running, the better that works because you've got really good evidence to work from. If you just had habit and logic, life would be awesome. You would always be able to perform to the level of your training and your fitness and your talent. That would be great. However, the human brain is not designed for us to be runners. It's designed for our survival. So at its very core, it has a tiny part of the brain, or it's actually two that look a bit like almonds, called the amygdala. And I call this the threat system. And so when I'm working with somebody, what we're spending a lot of time doing is trying to work out what it is that triggers their threat system. Because when the threat system triggers, you no longer have access to logic. You've got access to the habits. You can still physically run, but there's no logic there. You can't persuade yourself, I've just had a gel. I will feel much, much better in 20 minutes. I just need to jog this through and then I'll be there. Your threat system has flipped, and you're just like, no flipping chance am I doing anything else. I am pulling out right now. So, when the threat system flips and you can't access your logic, it also means you get really negative head chatter because it wants you to stay in your comfort zone, which in something like long running is stopping, pulling over, going much, much slower. So, there's a big thing about staying in your comfort zone with negative head chatter. Our body shape changes. We want to go small and fast. But sometimes that's fast away from where we're supposed to be going. It's like, I'll do whatever it takes just to get off this course right now. And our body shape changes, so we can't run so well. We're almost like crushing our lungs, so we can't breathe.
That's mental. So your body shape physically changes.
It's the idea behind the amygdala when humans, millions of years ago, and all these elements were developed within us, was to be able to run away from physical threat. So if there is a saber-toothed tiger on the loose, you need to be able to do one of four things. You need to be able to fight it. We don't fight it in running. We get very chatty. It's the chatty people at the
You
start line.
could offer it a gel or a sandwich.
That is one of the responses, right? So you fight it, you flight it, you run away. Fawn is where you're a big people pleaser.
Oh,
So
wow.
yes, you would offer it a gel or a sandwich. I see fawn responses actually most in sports where they can often have some quite abusive, horrible coaching. So I
Right.
see it in rowing, in hockey, in gymnastics, where people have grown up with not nice coaching. They'll have more of that fawn response. Actually, the responses I see the most with people who have performance anxiety is a freeze response. It's
Oh.
like you're going to stand really still and pretend to be a tree so that saber-toothed tiger goes straight on by. And so part of that response is like, I just want to get away from here. I want to be smaller. I don't want that saber-toothed tiger to see me. So you get small and fast. And the big one, the one runners will notice the most, is that when your threat system triggers, it sends adrenaline and cortisol around your body. First place they go is your tummy. So I work with a number of young athletes that will be throwing up before competitions. But most people go to the toilet a lot. In fact, a friend of mine, he was chatting about a half marathon they were doing, said, oh, it was a three poo kind of morning. And I was just like, there you go. That shows you cared. That was the cortisol. It's gone to your tummy. It wants to make you as light as possible to escape this scary thing it's imagining. It's not a physical threat, it's a psychological threat, but the same process happens. Next thing that happens, heart rate gets faster, breathing rate gets faster. Like, that's not so bad actually over an ultra because everything's a bit all over the place anyway. Not so great if you're doing a short race where you need to be able to push yourself into those higher realms. A big one, not so bad in running, but really bad in sports like tennis or golf, is that our back and shoulder muscles get super, super tight. And that means if you watch the Wimbledon final, women's Wimbledon final a couple of weeks ago, and that player clearly was in a freeze mode, just incredibly hard at that point to serve or to hit the ball. Because although the movement pattern is embedded within your habit function, the tension in your back and shoulder muscles means you're not going to hit the ball where it needs to go.
That's actually really interesting because I have had that in ultras where suddenly my back, I feel like I'm like, ah, why is that hurting so much? And I've been able to go, that's because you're thinking of time constriction, you're thinking of cut-offs, you're thinking, where's that person behind me? And you're literally holding yourself up and you're running too fast and you need to chill the fuck out.
Totally.
Yeah, and I get athletes saying, how can I build my upper body so that my shoulders don't hurt like that? And I'm like, it's mindset. It's what's going on in your
Yes.
head.
Yeah. So you get those muscle tension. You also get your senses switch off. You don't need your senses if a saber-toothed tiger is chasing you. So that impacts us differently in different sports or activities. But you think you're doing 100-meter sprints. And the gun goes off, and you're just because your hearing's gone because you're so nervous, you don't quite hear it as fast as others. That's your race done for. And obviously, if you're ultra running and you're out and about a lot, you do need your hearing. You do need to be able to notice kind of the atmosphere, what's going on. So that can be quite tricky. So you have all of those responses going on, and usually they're either triggered by physical threat. Obviously, there's not that much physical threat for most of what we're doing. Psychological threat, I'm not good enough. I might be judged. I might be slower than last time. I might lose. Fred might overtake me. All of those physical, psychological elements. And then also sometimes physiological elements, particularly if you're injured. Like if I was to go out for a run now, first place my brain would go to is my poorly foot of like, what's going on? Is it triggering? Is it injured? Is it hurt? Should I be doing this? So we have those two. We have the physiological and we have the psychological. And psychologically, what we're most worried about is the outcome and what the outcome means about us. So if I was to go and do an ultra, I wouldn't be worried about the outcome because it's not my thing. I'm very happy at short distances. Anything over 10K is a big effort for me, right? So I go and do that. That would be all about the experience or seeing if it's possible. It wouldn't be about if I don't do this, I am a failure because there's no identity attached to it. But if your identity is as I'm an ultra runner, I run really long distances. This is who I am. This is where all my friends are. This is what everybody else in my world knows me as. Then races are going to start to feel much, much more uncomfortable. And if they're uncomfortable and you're overthinking lots of the elements, you do what we call flipping the lid. your threat system comes out, takes over your body, you get the bad tummy, you've got the negative head chatter go, oh, you're not good enough. Maybe you should stop. Right? But use this as an excuse to stop. Back and shoulder muscles get tight because suddenly it's too important to you. There's lots of tools we use to help with that. But first off, I find it so helpful to be able to almost like you've got a drone above your head looking down on your brain going, ah, this is what's going on, and this is which bit's in charge right now.
Do you know what's right? Here's a question for you, right? That thing about having your identity attached to being an ultra runner, do you think that the rise, that the fact that we are so entrenched in social media, so the way I live my life as a coach, as an ultra runner, same with Damien, probably to a point the same with Kirsty, who's our other coach, and Holly, because Holly's a coach as well. We live in a world where this is our identity. We're coaches, we're in it, we do it, that's what we do. For most people I coach, they have a normal job, they have a couple of kids, they're training for like Race to the Stones, or they're training for a 50 miler. It's not their identity. It's the first time they've done it, yet they think it is. Do you think social media has got something to do with this? Because they're so worried about outcome that I'm looking at the way that you see it, and that's how I want them to see it. I'm like, there will be an outcome. We don't need to worry about what that will be. It will just be an outcome. It's just neutral. But their identity is attached to it. Do you think that has something to do with the fact that they believe that they are more in that identity than they actually are?
100%. Yeah. So, for example, I had a book on ADHD and sport come out in April. I do not have ADHD. I work with lots of people who do, but that means on social media, I follow a lot of people who talk about it. And over time, you start seeing kind of what the algorithm is giving you, and you're almost getting to a point of like, oh, maybe I do.
Do you know
Because
what? I've been told by normal people that I have ADHD, and I'm like, I'm pretty sure I don't have it because so many normal people, like normal, just random people that I don't know, have said, do you think you've got ADHD? I'm like, maybe I have got ADHD, but I don't think I have. But it's like I'm gaslighting myself into thinking I have.
when you live in a certain world, you get really ingrained in that bubble. And I mean, I will often, because I work quite a lot with juniors, I will often have juniors go, well, my mum says that so and so on social media is doing this, so I should be doing this too. So it isn't just us and what we see, it is everybody else going, oh, yeah, but I thought ultra runners do this. And so other people get an idea of what our identity should be. And often they will say something that is just making small talk. Like, oh, have you got a race entered at the moment? What are you working towards? Actually, that starts to make you go, oh, no, I should have a race I'm working towards. Oh, no, I'm supposed to be an ultra runner. So I think one of the things social media does to us is give us quite a mono identity. And actually, if you want to use social media to grow your brand, and I hate all that phrasing, but no, if you want to use it to be able to do some of the cool stuff that can come in this world, you have to have a mono identity. People don't want to see something that you put up and go, oh, are they talking about this thing or mothering or running or whatever? That's too complicated for kind of how we see social media. We want to think of one person and runner. Like, one of my favorite people to follow is Philly Bowden.
Oh,
Just
yeah.
love the way she does stuff, right? But it's like Philly Bowden runner. Similarly, lots of the stuff in tennis a few years ago, poor Emma Raducanu, she's just gone back to uni to study art. And I was like, awesome, because at the moment, Emma Raducanu, tennis. There's no separation. Tom Daley, diving. And then when they find something else, you can see how helpful it can be to be Tom Daley knitting, Tom Daley dad. So it is really important that we have more identities, so that actually, if our running's not going so well, we've got other things we can embed ourselves in.
Yeah, because it seems like it's the most important for a lot of athletes. It seems like it's the most important thing. And it's not, it's a hobby. It's supposed to bring us joy. It's supposed to bring us be fun.
Problem is, we tend to get into running because we want to get fitter or we want to help our mental health. And it's phenomenally good for that.
Well, it used to be. I'm like, does it help our mental health at the moment?
Well,
Is it
that's the
helping my
point.
athlete's mental health?
It is phenomenally good for that until you take it seriously, because that then tends to strip lots of the joy out of it and it adds a bunch of extra pressures in. So I did some research when I was training to be a sports psych in the impact of social media and technology on exercise addiction.
Oh, this sounds great.
So, yes, I gave a survey out to, I think I had 666
Wow.
ultra endurance athletes. I know. That was just the numbers randomly, but they were all ultra endurance athletes. So, they're all running marathons or longer. Kind of Ironman distance triathlon, long swimming, long riding, four teams. And on average, I think around 44% had a risk of exercise addiction. Right? So it's, you can't, there's no diagnosis for exercise addiction. It's not kind of categorized as a mental health
I was
disorder.
going to say, is it like, so when people talk about, when I talk about addiction, I talk about doing something, a repeated behavior that has a detrimental effect on me that I repeat regardless of the detrimental effect.
Yes, 100%. And it's about the effect. It's not how much you do.
Yeah. So I'm like,
So,
because people often say to me, have you replaced one addiction with another? And I'm like, absolutely fucking not, because I'm not addicted to running. If I'm injured, I'll stop. Whereas with drinking, if I was injured, I'd fucking keep going. Simple as that.
yes. Yeah. So, but there will be some people that will miss out family events. They will have huge fights with other people if somebody tries to stop them, is unable to cope when they are injured. I've worked with people who have pelvic stress fractures and still run. And I've had a pelvic stress fracture. I can still feel the pain, and it was 15 years ago, right? I have no idea. I mean, incredibly powerful mind to be able to override that pain, but obviously incredibly unhelpful for long-term health. So there are lots and lots of endurance athletes who are at risk of exercise addiction. And when I looked at the figures, yes, they are more likely to have that risk if they are posting a lot on things like Strava. And with it, after I'd done all the surveys, I then interviewed 12 people in much more depth. They were people who had a very high risk of exercise addiction and used a lot of technology to try and delve into why that was. And I will always remember one girl who said, I'd been injured. I was coming back from injury and I went for a long run by the canal, and it was beautiful, and the birds were singing, and it was a sunny day, and I was just back in my happy place, and I was so excited, and I loved it. And I got home, and my watch uploaded to Strava, and then I saw my brother had run further than me, and my friends had run faster, and I knew I was a total waste of space. And you're like,
I can't
oh.
even, it just makes me want to cry.
So, and the fact it's kind of other people were saying, like, I went out for a long ride and my Garmin died on my bike, and I was suddenly relieved that I wouldn't be able to share it and I could just go and enjoy my ride. And you're like, and all of us are amateurs, all of this stuff is supposed to be fun. And yes, it makes us feel amazing if we get a new PB. And I like Philly Bowden stuff of the grind, because actually having that discipline to go through the grind and sometimes to do the work on the days you don't want to is an incredible feeling, and it can make you feel very powerful, and it can give you a huge dopamine buzz, and it can help you learn lessons for the rest of your life. For example, my daughter Blessa just had her grade one ballet exam. And we practiced every single day for 3 weeks when she got. And we got her results yesterday and she got a distinction for it, right?
Amazing.
And suddenly she's like, and I was like, what's the lesson? And she's like, if you practice really hard, you can get really good. And I was like, that is a great lesson, not because of the outcome, but because actually she could see going through things that are sometimes boring can give you something really good
Yeah, and
in the end.
it's the process, isn't it? It's the
Yeah,
process of doing that
totally.
thing.
So
Go on.
that bit is brilliant. But when we connect back to the identity bit, if we connect our identity to that result, and I know she hadn't got a distinction because actually she was poorly on the day of the exam, you don't want somebody falling apart or thinking they're not worthy of who they are or they're not a good person because they didn't get a great result. It's like you tried really hard. It should always be about the input. What's my input to this race or this challenge that I've set? The output should feel as irrelevant as possible.
I'm pretty sure there's people listening to this who are like,
That is exactly me. Especially, I don't understand people's relationship with Strava because I only use it as a mechanism to record where I ran and how many miles I've done in a year. Never go on it. Don't do Qs. Not interested. So I've kind of swerved that, and I'm fucking glad that I have swerved it. But I know people that get fucked off when their mates don't give them kudos, that stare at it, that look at it all day and use it as a metric for success. I went on a podcast the other day and they were arguing over whether their friend had done a 50-mile race in 9 hours, under 9:15, because the chip time was 9:16:01 and his Strava time was 9:14:59. Which do you believe? We've been debating it for ages. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, when people have that obsession with either looking at what other people are doing on Instagram or Strava, where do they start to untangle that?
So I would say many of those people are doing it because they have perfectionism as a trait. And there are three types of perfectionism. So there's kind of very self-driven perfectionism where you're setting a really high bar and you work really hard towards it. You're never going to get close and go, "Oh, look how awesome I am." Because actually you're just going to raise the bar. And there's always going to be this gap between where you are and where you think you should be. But those people will do well because they'll work really, really hard. They just don't enjoy the process as much as they should. And that might curtail some of their long-term running. But then you also have social perfectionism. And that's where you're looking at everybody else and comparing yourself to them. And then you have kind of an external perfectionism where you're judging everybody else. So actually, I very rarely work with people that are judging anybody else. The people I work with are coming because they're judging themselves and they don't want to do that. They can see it's holding them back. So to work on perfectionism, we will start to try and help them fail in a safe way, but gives your brain evidence that it's better to learn than to always kind of pass, win, strive. One of the loveliest examples I have of this is Dame Sarah Storey, who got lucky enough to ride out in Lanzarote with her a few years ago. And she said something about, "I don't always like winning." And I'm like, "Well, you can say that. You've won more than any other Paralympic athlete, I think, on the planet, like the most winningest you could be."
You're the most winningest. I love
I don't think
that.
that's a word, but we'll go with
It's perfect.
it. Like, you can't do better than she is. She's phenomenal. She said, "Yeah, but when you win, you can't learn. And I am not about being the most winningest. I am about being the best I can possibly be. And how can you be the best you can possibly be if you can't see the route to being even better?" And I think that mindset is why she's been so phenomenally exceptional for so many years. So we are trying to put people into a learning mindset, a real challenge one, rather than a winning one, because the winning one brings in a ton of threat, triggers your threat system, makes it harder to perform well. So we're trying to focus on mastery rather than kind of perfectionism. In fact, my daughter's favorite quote, she likes quoting back to me, is, "Practice makes progress."
Nice.
Good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
And then the social perfectionism one. Again, one, you want to try and build your own confidence so you're less feeling like you have to compare yourself to everybody else. Another part of it is really trying to focus on your own journey of where you've come from, the things that you are dealing with that other people might not. And sometimes I will set somebody a challenge to look through the posts on social media or Strava of somebody they do know really well and collate what they know about this person in real life and what shows up on social media. Because they will be very, very different. And I know from athletes I work with, we'll do a session and they'll be very vulnerable. They'll be talking about all of those difficulties that are truly going on in their life and we'll work through them. But I might see on social media the next
Nailed
day
it. Nailed this
something that looks
sesh.
awesome. And that's brilliant. We all do that kind of, I guess, we all want to control the narrative about what other people see about us. And that's absolutely fine to do. But often there is far, far more going on behind the scenes. And so if we are looking at social media and we are seeing the shiny, glossy parts of everybody else's life, and we were comparing them with the nuts and bolts, grim, horrible, dark stuff of our own life, we're always going to feel rubbish. So I think you can use social media for good at times, to learn and to be entertained. If we take it as truth, we would think everybody else in the world is living their best life and we're living our shittiest one. And that's not the case.
It's fascinating, right? Because I think people, social media is such a big thing that like people forget what they're doing. And I have conversations with athletes where they're like, it was terrible. I had an awful time. Like, it was the worst day of my life. I just thought maybe I just don't want to do this anymore. And I'm like, on Saturday, I literally saw you post. It was, you had the greatest time of your life. And it was amazing. You felt super strong and you met loads of friends and there's pictures of you like this. And so I'm like, which one is it? And I know which one it is, but I think they forget. They forget I'm going to see that. And they forget we're going to have that conversation because it's almost automatic. Let's put the highlights reel up. Let's put the highlights reel up. And I know a lot of people say, oh, I'm really honest on social media, but they're not. Like, it's such a difficult thing. I think it's probably the thing I face the most with athletes is this idea of, well, success, really. Like, what success looks like based on their perception across Strava or social media.
Yes.
So when it comes to your athletes, how important is success? Well, how do they define success? How do is everybody's different, or is there, do you feel like there is sort of an overarching psychological definition of how people feel like they've been a success?
So when I wrote the 10 Pillars of Success, the book that was kind of these are 10 evidence-based characteristics that make us most successful in life. And then we had a famous-ish person who brought each chapter to life. So Sarah Pascoe talked about internal insight, Maxine Peake talked about mastery, Damien talked about purpose. So they really brought each chapter to life. And then for the final chapter, I asked them, what does success mean to you? And actually, that was the most illuminating element. So lots of them had said, particularly we had a stuntman who was fascinating,
Wow.
right? He and
Wow.
he's Chris Hemsworth's stunt double. I never got to meet him in real life. It was during COVID and I had to do it all online.
God damn it. Did he look like Chris Hemsworth? I'm just asking for a friend.
he looked very, very fit.
He did from behind. He looked like him from behind.
Some James Bond too. He had some fascinating stories, right?
Wow.
But he said specifically, I thought success was fame and fortune. Right? And he's done the Hollywood stuff and all of that. And he said, but because of what you have to go through as a stuntman, I've had some, and he'd grown up as a gymnast too, that I had to have spinal surgery a few years ago. And I was in a wheelchair for quite a while and I got addicted to the painkillers. And he said, it was my wife and her daughter. They got me through it. They cared for me. They loved me. They looked after me. Having family around you is success, not fame and fortune. Maxine Peake said, I thought it was name up in lights. That's why when I went through all those years of trying to get into drama school, it was going to be like having your name in lights outside of theatre. She went, no, it's getting to do something you love every day and getting paid for it. Someone's prepared to pay you to do something you love.
Yeah, you're constantly like,
That's
someone's gonna
success.
find out in a minute that
Yes, I'm going to get caught out.
I like
And Dame Kelly Holmes said she thought it was gold medals until she got two Olympic gold medals. And then she realized it was nothing to do with medals. It was a sense of belonging. It was
Oh,
a
yeah.
sense of being part of something bigger and being able to use that sense for good. And so I just, all of those kind of brought it home that when we think of success, we might think of having a certain amount of money in the bank, or being well known. Or some people would literally say it's having 100,000 followers on Instagram.
If you Google it, if AI tells you the definition of success
Yeah.
is fame and money. That's what
Oh.
we are told. If you go onto Google and Google what is success, it will tell you it's fame and money. That's what it
Wow.
is. So we are, it is indoctrinated into us that this is what success is, and it isn't that at all.
No. And actually, what really came out from the book that I saw, there was a lovely element in the chapter on purpose, which is a Japanese phrase, and I'm going to say it wrong, but it's something like igaki. And it means having lived with purpose, really. So it's the idea that you're 80, you're in your rocking chair, You're able to look back over your life and you have left the world a better place because you were in it. Somewhere you have touched another person in a way that means their life is better, wider lives are better. And I love that element of like how, and we can use that in our running because it's
Yeah,
like, how are you
100%,
leaving
a
the
hundred
world
percent.
a better place? And that's kind of easy, I guess, if you're coaching. My purpose is very much around my job. But other people might well have a purpose. It's nothing to do with their running, but their running will help give them headspace to work through how to do better in their purpose. Or it means they get to know more people where they can spread the message that does matter to them. So I would say a lot of success is about knowing your purpose and having tools in place to be able to achieve that.
I totally agree with that. And I think when I talk to, athletes get so wound up about cutoffs, finishing races, like all that stuff. But I always say to them when would you do this if nobody was watching is the first big question. Like, would you do this if you couldn't put this on Strava and nobody could ever say well done? And what is the why? What is the purpose behind it? Like, my purpose is to be an example of what is possible, and that is to say you can fuck up your life exponentially and there is always space for you to be able to pull it round again. And you won't be perfect and things will go wrong and it'll be cyclical, but no matter what happens, you can recover. And especially as, a female doing this sort of stuff, I will die knowing I have had an impact on people, and that's fucking incredible. And it just makes none of the winning things and finishing things doesn't matter. It's about the ongoing journey. What steps can people take for them to discover what their purpose is if they're not sure? And I'm talking about your sort of mid-pack race to the stones runner.
It is really hard to find your purpose. Once in 10 years of working with athletes, someone has been able to tell me their purpose instantly. And that was a 23-year-old who wanted to show other girls from her background that you could go pro in her sport. That was a very clear one. And it was so powerful because it meant when, say, very shy, very kind of, I don't want to take up space. I'm not worthy of taking up space. But when they were injured, too scared to go and see the physio at the club to get help because maybe other people deserve that help more, right? But with the purpose, it was like, how are you going to get a pro contract if you're injured? Oh, yeah, maybe I should go and see the physio. Yeah. So it opens up more doors because it matters to you. So I often say, get I can have a Venn diagram, right? So you want a Venn diagram of what you love, what you're really good at, and what makes you incensed when you watch the news, right? So one of the things that makes me incensed when I'm scrolling through, and I avoid the news now, but when I'm scrolling through Instagram, the thing that makes me most annoyed is women in sport not being given equality to men. Like the 6% of sports coverage that women get, and how we absolutely need to be far better role modeling to our daughters. So even now, my daughter gets told she can't play football because she's a girl, right? And you're like,
Thought we were
it
done with
irritates
that.
me.
Josie, I thought we were done with that. I thought that was done.
So did I. But still, schools in London, she will have little boys telling her, oh, girls don't play football. Right, so we're not done with that, and it's infuriating, right? So, in fact, I sat through the whole football match the other night with her because I was like, "We are watching this." I mean, it was a really good match,
I
but
think you need to go and get those kids from our school. The boys drag them by their hair into your house and get them to watch it.
do you know what I did for one of them? This is so inappropriate. So it was his birthday, and obviously the whole class goes to the birthday parties. So I bought him, I think it was Beth Mead's book on how to be a brilliant footballer. And we bought that as his birthday present.
Perfect.
That's like so passive aggressive.
Love it. Love it.
So yeah, women in sport and women not being revered in sport in the way that men are, my thing, right? So that then very much helps you go, right, that really annoys me. I want to do something about that. That triggers my threat system. There's an area I want to do something about. So that should be part of my purpose. And then you can start to kind of go, well, what's in the middle of all that? How could I do better? So for me, that means, I probably shouldn't say this in public, But I will sometimes offer much cheaper rates to do workshops with young girls in sport.
There's nothing wrong with that. If that's your passion, that's your passion.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I got asked to do something by Lego a few years ago about getting young girls more into sport, and I was like, I don't care what you pay, I'm doing it. Like, that's, you can see, and it's like, well, yeah, then I can use the things hopefully I'm good at as a sports psych and as a communicator to help in an area that matters to me. So you can't just randomly pick a purpose and go, I'm off to do that. But I mean, we talked in the book about Damien and kind of the green element, and you can see how that fuels. I read something yesterday where he put, I'd like to do this race, but the carbon footprint to do it would be too much right now. Great. Like, you can see someone living by their purpose. That one means you've lived a better life, but it also means, I remember that you have that impact on other people who might change their behaviors. And I don't want to embarrass you, but I read your book a couple of years ago, and it was one of the first things that made me start thinking, I don't know if I want to drink anymore. Not as in I had an awful relationship, but just a, I don't think this is doing me any good. I don't think I'm being the best version of me because I'm having a glass of wine often in an evening. And I've now stopped drinking for the last 6 months and feel so,
Congratulations.
yeah, I feel so much better. My resting heart rate's down 5 beats on average. Yeah, like, you could see visuals of, like, this works. And so it's just more and more people talking about good stuff and sharing their experiences can make you go, oh, maybe that should be more of my purpose. And it doesn't have to be stuck in stone, it can shift. But I think it's really important to try and find what it is and to be really intentional with going out to go, I don't want to drift through life, I want a purpose.
Yeah, but also you're not approaching, especially running with a scattergun approach. I'll mention values in a minute, but with the purpose stuff, having that purpose, so you get what you love, what you're good at, and what makes you angry, whack it into a Venn diagram, right? Work out what it is, because then when you stand at the start of your race, instead of going, oh, I'm going to be the slowest, or I want to win, or this person looks fitter than me, you can stand there and go, that's not what I'm here for. I'm not here to look better than that person, or win, or beat that person, or I'm not here for any of that. What I'm here to do is show my daughter that I'm a strong woman who goes and tries, and the outcome doesn't really matter. The fact I'm standing at the start line is enough. Or to go and showcase the fact that I'm a green runner and I got here on my bike and I'm going to go home on my bike and enjoy the day. If you have purpose, if you have value, a value system, you can signpost back to it. So when all of that external chatter about, like, how fast Strava, the guy next door, the guy in accounts, what's so and so going to say, what if I DNF, doesn't actually matter, because that's not what you're fucking there for. And it's really
100%.
helpful.
And values can be really helpful in that approach because it can also really help you figure out more about your purpose. So something I will do with the athletes I work with, I give them a sheet of 100 words, and it's cross off and cross off and cross off until you found the words that apply to you. You normally have 50 words left because they're all good stuff to be. Get really, really harsh and cross out more. And then we're looking at which, if someone was to violate that word, that value, would it trigger your threat system?
That's
So if it
such a
does,
good way to do it.
yeah, if it doesn't trigger your threat system, it's not a core value. It's important, but it's not going to rile you. And we do it and do it until we've got about 10 to 12 words left. And then we look at those words and we try and spot the themes. Because we're not trying to say we're going to get our 3 words of our values off that list of 100. We're just trying to spot themes. Because often people have, like, being a good person
I
is
know.
their value. And
A
it's
lot of
sometimes
the
finding out
a
that.
lot of the time I find people with values, people say what they think you want to hear, or they say what makes them a good person. And it's like, it's not a judgment system. It's, we're not judging if you're a good person. If financial security is one of your values, that's fucking fine, but you need to be honest about it. Like, I often get people who are like, well, I think it's kindness, it's honesty. And I'm like, is that really the most important to you? Or is financial security important to you? Is being curious important to you? Is your family the most important to you? So, and I think, so what you're saying is such a great way to do it. And I think it's worth people getting help with it, because it opens so many doors and closes the ones you want shut.
Yes, and I always suggest, even when we've come down to those three words, it's a sense of like, go and play with them in your head and go and test them out. And when we've got them, we tend to do three things. One is consider what scenarios might trigger your threat system based on those values. So I do a local park run. There's a guy that cheats. He cuts the course, right?
That
He's in
is
a
severely against my values.
Right, so you've got a justice
I
value.
literally want to know who he is.
Right.
I've got integrity and honesty. There's no integrity in that. There's no honesty in it.
Right, yeah. And he's in his 60s, about 25, 26 minutes. There's not much point for cutting the corners, right? But it makes me laugh because I just laugh at it. You're like, why? I'm confused. And I'm like, I'd love to know and I'd love to go and ask you. But I have a friend that gets so angry by it. She wants to go shout at him. She wants to report him to headquarters.
Want to report him to headquarters.
Right. So yeah, that suggests that there's a value around integrity, honesty, injustice, those kind of things, right? So it's very helpful to say, I am going into this race. Where could my values get violated within that? And how am I going to pre-prepare for it so that if my value gets violated, I can deal with it better? So we constantly have that idea of I need to know my values because they could get triggered, and how am I going to deal with that? We then can have more what we call value-based actions. How do you live more in line with your values every day? So if kindness were a value, maybe you're the person that always holds doors open for people. Maybe you pay it back in a coffee shop and you pay for an extra coffee for somebody else. Maybe you do go up to that woman on the tube that's got an awesome jumpsuit and say, I just wanted to let you know you look awesome today. Like you would find things to do that help you feel more you. And the biggest one I use for people with performance anxiety is that when your threat system is trying to keep you in your comfort zone and not push you to do really cool things, you are able to do what you wanted to do in spite of the fear, in the service of your values. So you mentioned one earlier that I want my daughter to know you work hard. When things are difficult, you get your head down and you push through because you set a goal for a reason and you
And
want
it's easy
to
to do the work when things are easy. It's
do it.
easy
Totally.
to do it. But when things are fucking hard, that's when you need to show up.
Yes. And two of my values, family and bravery. So the whole thing, if I'm running and my back hurts and my threat system's triggered, and my threat system's called Lazy Larry. So Lazy Larry is piped up and he's going, you could slow down, Josie. You don't want to do this. No one knows. You can, who cares? Go home. All of that stuff. It's like, I'm noticing that Lazy Larry is telling me all of this. However, it matters to me that I am the best role model I can be for my daughter. And I want her to be brave. And so I need to be able to give her that medal at the end. So sorry, Lazy Larry, but we're going for it. And it really, really helps. Knowing your values that clearly so helps you overcome the negative head chatter.
I think it's really important to say that when you do define your values, it's not about just about your values towards other people. So it's about your values towards yourself. So a lot of the time when I'm like, because people mistake kindness for niceness. And a lot of people are like, how can kindness be one of your values when you bored me out for not doing my session? And I'm like, because it would be fucking unkind of me to not bore you out. It wouldn't be me showing you a kindness as a coach if I wasn't holding you accountable. And you're not being honest and you're not showing integrity. So of course I'm going to bore you out, right? Kindness and niceness are not the fucking same thing. And the other thing is kindness and bravery to yourself. Am I being kind to myself? Am I talking to myself nicely? Am I being honest with myself? Am I showing integrity to myself and my actions? One of the things that, and I won't blow smoke up his ass, but I really admire about Damien is he does stick to those, that purpose he has and to those values he
Massively.
has. And it gets on my nerves because we can't go on holiday. We can't go to certain places. We can't do certain stuff. We can't go to certain restaurants. It's a pain in the ass. It costs us money because he has to fucking not fly anywhere. But he is so good at sticking to it because he cares so much about it. And you know when those values are core, because even when it makes your life difficult, you will do your best to remain in line with them. And you will slip up, but
Yes.
you'll do your best to remain in line with them. And I think that's where the success comes in, because you'll feel super comfortable and content. You might not feel happy, but you'll feel calm and content because you know you're doing the best job that you can for yourself.
Totally.
Right, we've not got much time. We've got questions. This is from Phil. Hi, my 10-year-old son is a very driven and competitive young runner swimmer and is progressing really quickly. He can swim a mile in about 45 minutes and has just done a sub 27 minute 5K on the trails. I've always gone at his pace and not pushed him, but he's dreaming really big. How do you keep young people grounded without discouraging them?
Ooh.
I think we see a lot of this at Junior Park Run.
Oh my
Junior
God,
Park
you know.
Run Dad is a toxic thing and it's a
So
breed.
on Sunday, I marshalled a family non-competitive triathlon. My daughter was doing it with my husband. It was joyful. I
It actually
loved
sounds like
it.
quite good fun, and I hate the idea of triathlon, but that sounds like fun.
Yeah, all the kids got to swim in the lake with their parents, so they felt totally safe. As many laps as they wanted on the bike, and then as many laps as they wanted to run.
That sounds amazing.
It
I'd do
was.
that.
Barnes Fitness put it on. They did such a good job. I loved it, right?
I'm going to
And I'm
borrow a
marshalling.
child and do it.
Yes. And one of the dads came past and shouted, "Hunt them down," to his son.
Was it the Liver King? Who was that guy? Did he have a fucking spear in his hand?
I was just like, really? It's non-competitive. You can do as many laps as you want. Who are you hunting down? But anyway, yes, there are a lot of the park run dads. I see. I literally go to triathlons and I want to hand out my business card and say, call me in 5 years' time when you've destroyed your kid. Because I see, I won't do that, I'm professional. I see the.
I'll get your t-shirt made with a QR code on the back so people, as you walk past, they can just sneakily go, I need to do that, but I don't want to take a
Want
card.
to rescue your child.
Yeah.
I work with the 25-year-olds that are coming out the other side and still have mum or dad's voices in their head saying, particularly the word should. You should be able
Yeah.
to do this. It's such a shaming word and it gets embedded. And when I talk about, say, Lazy Larry, when I work on with an athlete about creating their version, often what they say is, and I said, what voice do you hear when you hear your version of Lazy Larry? And they'll think about it and they're like, dad's.
I get that all the time. My parents, my mum, my dad. Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't, you want to encourage. You want to help them focus on the right things. It's never about the outcome. So it shouldn't be if you can get a PB, I'm taking you for breakfast. It should be, what would you like to focus on in this park run? And they're like, I want to see if I can feel properly out of breath at the end because I've really pushed it. Okay. If you're properly out of breath at the end, we're going to do something really cool. So you are always rewarding the effort and not the outcome. And sometimes the effort, particularly for more nervous, anxious children, is the starting, is the turning up to somewhere.
Oh yeah,
That's
my friend Julius's son stopped going to parkrun because he couldn't bear the start because of all the chatter from the other kids and dads. He was like, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, and he couldn't even start, and his running has stopped.
yeah. And so a lot of it is just really, really focused. And for adults too, focus on what input you want to have to your run. What would make you feel proud when you cross the finish line before you see a time? But what would make you feel proud about how you performed on that day? And really, really share that with your kids. So when my daughter was doing her ballet exam, I was like, I will be happy if you smiled and you pointed your toes nicely. Those are the two things that will make the biggest difference to how you perform in that exam. And the hardest thing for a parent is not asking the result. But
That's
if
a
you
really
can
good
do
point.
that, it's amazing. So when they cross the finish line, just don't talk about the results. Talk about, oh, are you proud of how you ran that? I saw you overtake so and so. Was that bit hard? Was it enjoyable? Did you chat to Fred at the start? What are they up to for the rest of the day?
Oh, it makes me feel so, makes me feel better, and I'm 43.
But the whole, what time did you do? That's totally irrelevant. And we perform better when we go that way. So I've had a lot of tennis players or golfers, and they get really nervous because they know they have to go back in a clubhouse afterwards, and someone is going to say, how was it out there? And they translate that as, how did you do? In fact, I had a friend who's a sports psychologist who put onto Twitter when it was still a thing, did Berlin Marathon today. And I replied going, how was it? And they said something like, 3:15.
Oh God, that's not what I asked.
I was like, that is not what I asked. How was it? And they were like, oh my God, the crowds were amazing. The support was this. And it's like, that's what matters. Like, what's the story? I did Windsor Triathlon the other week. Can't remember the time. I remember there were loads of dead squirrels, and the marshal that was dealing with all the drafting just kept coming along, and he was leaning over the side of his motorbike to scoop up dead squirrels off the road.
My dog would have fucking loved that. Summer job, mum. I've got a summer job. Right.
But that's what we remember in life, right? We remember stories. And we interviewed, I do a podcast with a lovely friend of mine called Annie Emerson, all about how to be braver. And we interviewed Vassos Alexander recently, who said he doesn't mind when things go wrong in a race because it's a better story at the end of it. And the more we can help our kids remember the great stories from the things they do and less focus on the times, the more they'll enjoy it and the longer they'll stick with it.
Excellent answer. I've got probably time for one more. My friend Sean, no doubt this will be a point of conversation. It wasn't. But I would be interested in thoughts on DNFs or races that didn't go to plan. We invest so much time in training, then when a race goes to shit, it can be a really hard thing to deal with. How is that about setting your intentions out, or is that about problem solving on the race? Like, what do we do? I have so many people who are terrified of DNFs or who really struggle to get over them. What is your thoughts on that?
And it's the hardest thing of knowing, is my body genuinely broken right now, or is it my brain trying to stop me? And our brains are very good. It's very rough science, but on average, when our body wants us to stop, like if we were to be on a treadmill and do one of those two exhaustion tests and press a big red button because there is nothing else left in us, we actually have about 30% of energy.
30%.
Yeah. So it's
Oh
a nice
God.
fact to know when your body's going, can't do any more of this. Of like, if we needed it would be there. If there was something that would motivate us enough, we would find that energy. We'd be able to get it out of ourselves. So we're often trying to work out, is this just a lack of motivation? Is my perception of effort too high? Or is this a genuine issue? And very occasionally, I will work with an athlete where we're like, this is the biggest event of my life. It's the Olympics, Paralympics. I don't care how much it hurts. I am finishing or I collapse. Most of the time, that's not a good approach to take, right? Because that might put you out of your sport for the next 6 months with some proper severe injury. So most of the time, we're not going down that route. So you can do it, and there are tools you can do to get you through it if it's the biggest thing you're ever going to do. But for most of us, actually, we want to be able to carry on. We don't want to be out the next 6 months because we've run through a stress fracture or something. So we are trying to learn to listen better to our body, but also give ourselves the best environment for our brain to perform well. So one of the biggest things in ultra running is low blood sugar levels will trigger your threat system. So if you can work on better on your nutrition so that your blood sugar levels stay more stable, you are less likely to flip the lid, less likely to drop out and DNF. The phrase I really love comes from Alex Hutchinson, the guy that wrote Endure. It's a beautiful book, which is pain is information. We think pain is a bad thing. It's evil. But actually, often it is giving us some kind of information that we need to listen to. Like the pain is telling us you need to listen to this. Doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. It might mean you're improving because you're coming back from something and you're doing something you haven't done in a while. It might mean you need to change your technique. It might mean you need to get your poles out of your backpack. Like, but we always think pain is a bad thing, and it's not. And when we change our mentality to pain as information, we can start to be more curious about what is stopping us or what is making us want to stop. The other element is knowing your circadian rhythm, because we have a 90-minute circadian rhythm with a peak and a trough every 45 minutes within it. You're going to feel rubbish basically every 90 minutes. And if you're doing a long race, that's a lot of times feeling rubbish. But if you know your circadian rhythm, I remember doing Paris Marathon a couple of years ago. And about half an hour in, I was like, oh my God, I feel awful. This was bad. I'm never going to be able to run. You've got your whole head spinning away. And then it's like, oh, it's 10 o'clock. I'm on a dip. Mom's on a dip at 10 o'clock. The next dip will come at 11:30. Okay, gel. I'll be fine in 15 minutes.
Why don't people understand that when you're going to go out and run for 50 hours, that's 2 days of your life, and you don't have a day of your life where everything is fucking perfect all the time when you're sitting at your desk. So it's not going to happen in a race.
No. So I would say as a tip for that one is spot in the afternoon when you yawn and write down the times. And what you'll start to notice is there's a 90-minute cycle, and those will be your dips. And you extrapolate that around the day so that when you're running, you know when to expect you're going to have a dip and you're more likely to want a DNF at that point. But if you're looking out for it, then you're like, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to feel rubbish right now. Give me 20 minutes, I'll be fine. You're less likely to DNF.
Amazing. This has been so good. I know you've got stuff to do. Do you want to just quickly tell us about your podcast? Tell us about your books. Do a little plug.
Yep. So I have a podcast called the Be Braver podcast, which is myself and Annie Emerson. And we interview people that have had either had to be braver or they've chosen to be braver. And there's some really fascinating people who've just finished season one. And then, yeah, my new book is called ADHD in Sport. So it's written for ADHDers, but there are also chapters for coaches and for parents of how best to support athletes with ADHD, how to get the really good stuff from them, but also how to support with some of the difficulties that might show up.
Amazing.
And then my website is called performanceinmind.co.uk, and there's lots of free stuff on there.
Thank you so much. I appreciate this. It's been great. And thanks for ending our success season. I think people can take a lot away from this and hopefully
Amazing.
manage their success levels better. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Running Won't Save You podcast. If you have got 2 seconds, or maybe a bit longer, maybe a minute, can you head over to Apple or Spotify and give us 5 stars, please? We don't want to hear all the things you don't like about the pod, just the good stuff. We'd also encourage you, while you're on the internet, to go and check out Reaction Collective. Reaction Collective are a collective of wonderful human beings who are striving to make things a little bit better environmentally for everybody. They fix everything from tents to t-shirts, and they have an amazing collective. So go to have a look at Reaction Collective, Google it, you'll find it. Pre-Love Sports. We also support them. Pre-Love Sports sell secondhand kit, and they collect good quality secondhand kit to sell on as well, which encourages the circular economy of running. Into Ultra are an amazing charity who help people getting into the sport because it is very expensive, as we all know. So they're a great company to be part of, great charity to get involved with. Just Google Into Ultra to see how you can help. And finally, our favourites, the Green Runners. If you're not a member of the Green Runners, then why the hell aren't you? It's easy to pledge. It's only £2.50 a year, and you can wear the same badge as Jasmine Paris, so a bit of virtue signalling. Thanks to all of our friends, and thanks to you, the listener. We will see you next week.